The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, welcome one and all to episode number 70 of Wow. Walking Through the Language of the Heart with our good friend Chris S. Chris, welcome aboard once again. How the heck are you, my friend?
Monty, I'm doing really good, and it's wonderful to be on this this show again. I've just been, especially like the last half a dozen articles that we've gone through, been amazing. So I'm really enjoying myself.
Yeah, me too. This is I look forward to this every week. And I hope our listeners do too. And we've gotten several comments, people just really enjoying it. So this week it will why should this week be unlike any other week, right? We're going to enjoy this one too. What's this one called?
All right, this is from August 1961. It is on page 259 of The Language of the Heart, and it's called This Matter of Honesty.
Now
before we get going, my perspective on honesty has really kind of changed a lot. When I first got sober, you know, I thought of honesty, you know, very matter of fact, like, you know, giving the correct change, you know, if you borrowing somebody's lawnmower and giving it back, you know, in very concrete ways like that. Today, you know, I see honesty as if we're not honest with ourselves about step work, about our commitment to recovery, if we're not honest with ourselves about step one, you know, what are we really up against? If we're not honest with ourselves about step two and three, you know, coming to believe and making a real commitment to this thing, we're in trouble. And I notice this a lot. I've spoken about this on a couple of other shows. I do a treatment center commitment every Wednesday night. And half the time what I'm trying to do is get these people to really look at their life like, you know, honestly, objectively, what is the truth about where you're at in your life? Because we want to live in this, you know, delusional state of it's really not that bad, I've got this. You know, and if we're not honest, this is kind of what my perspective on honesty is morphed into. Let's see what Bill has to say about honesty. All right, so the problem of honesty touches nearly every aspect of our lives. There are, for example, the widespread and amazing phenomena of self-deception. There are those rather dreadful brands of reckless truth-telling, which are so often lacking in prudence and love. Then there are those countless life situations in which nothing less than utter honesty will do, no matter how sorely we may be tempted by the fear and pride this would reduce us to half-truths or inexcusable denials. Let's first see what self-deception can do to one's integrity. Well remembered is the comfort I used to take from an exaggerated belief in my own honesty. My New England kinsfolk had thoroughly taught me the sanctity of all business commitments and contracts. They insisted that a man's word is his bond. I delighted in the Lincoln story, which tells how Honest Abe once walked 6 miles to return the 6 pennies he had overcharged a poor woman at his grocery. After this rigorous conditioning, business honesty always came easy, and it stayed with me, even in Wall Street, where I landed years later. I never flim-flammed anyone. However, this small fragment of easy won virtue did produce some interesting liabilities. I was so absurdly proud of my business standards that I never failed to whip up a fine contempt for those of my fellow Wall Streeters who were prone to shortchange their customers. This was arrogant enough, but the ensuing self-deception proved even worse. My prized business honesty was presently converted into a comfortable cloak under which I could hide the many serious flaws that beset other departments of my life. Being certain of this one virtue, it was easy to conclude that I had them all. For years on end, this prevented me from taking a good look at myself. This is a very ordinary example of fabulous capacity for self-deception that nearly all of us can display at times. Moreover, the deception of others is nearly always rooted in the deception of ourselves. Mm. Man, what was occurring to me when I was reading this, Monty, was decades of self-appraisal. You know, continue to take personal inventory. Bill must have been doing that to get so deep into his character and so accurate in his self-assessment. You know what I mean? And humble enough to bring what he's discovered forward.
This would require, to do that, this would require the ability to, or even the willingness to admit that it's a never-ending story, right? It's a never-ending excursion into sometimes the unknown of yourself, and being willing to look at that. I mean, it's one thing to know that there's something you're afraid of and concerned that if you're found out and things like that, but it's a whole other thing to realize there may be stuff I don't even know yet, right?
Yeah, you know, I might uncover a whole nother layer of you know, character that needs work, you know?
What do you think he means by reckless truth-telling? That's an interesting statement.
All right, so reckless truth-telling might be, you know, somebody did something wrong at work or whatever, and you're going around, you're telling everybody about, oh, did you know what so-and-so did? You know, that might be like reckless truth-telling. You're telling the truth, but it might just be inappropriate for you to be telling it at that time and to the people you're telling.
I just flashed on Mark Lundholm, recovery comedian. He says, you know, just because it's the truth, should you say it? You know, like if you're in an elevator and you're passing gas, do you really want to admit that was you? It's the truth, but it might not be helpful to say it.
Yeah, reckless truth telling. That would qualify, I'm sure.
Yeah.
As further illustrations, two extreme cases come to mind. One shows self-delusion in a very obvious form. Obvious, that is, to all but the victim himself. The other depicts the more subtle brand of self-delusion from which no human being can be utterly exempt. So often we say things that Bill says as soon as we start reading again, you know, Monty?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're never gonna be finished with this work.
Uh-huh.
One of my good friends used to be a safecracker. He told me this revealing tale. He said, you know, Bill, I used to think I was kind of a one-man revolution against society. All over the world, I could see the have-nots taking it away from the haves. This seemed very reasonable. After all, those damn haves just wouldn't share their wealth. The resolutions that took it away from them were apt to get a lot of applause. But guys like me, who could also make those haves share their wealth, got no such glad hand. After a while, I figured this out. The plain fact was that nobody liked burglars. Revolutions, yes, but burglars, no. Anyway, I couldn't see anything wrong about blowing safes, except in getting caught. Even after years in jail, I still couldn't see it. When AA showed up, I slowly began to get it through my head that there were good revolutions and bad ones. Bit by bit, it dawned on me how I'd completely fooled myself. I could see that I had been pretty crazy. How could I have been that dumb? I'll never be able to explain it in any other way. You know, here's a funny fact. Like, I don't share this like at business meetings, Monty, but I am really close friends with three bank robbers.
Ah, that's great.
All three of them are in recovery, right? And they've really turned their lives around.
Yeah,
and, you know, one of them has gotten a Queen's pardon, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, one of them was running a treatment center after he got sober, you know, but you know, I just love the fact that there is redemption available
in
this thing called recovery, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my. Where would we be without it? We just wouldn't.
We wouldn't. Now, I have another AA friend, a good and gentle soul. He recently joined one of the great religious orders, one in which the friars spend many hours a day in contemplation. So my friend has plenty of time to take his inventory. The more he looks, the more unconscious self-deception he finds, and the more astonished he becomes at the elaborate and devious excuse-making machinery by which he had been justifying himself. He has already come to the conclusion that the prideful righteousness of good people may often be just as destructive as the glaring sins of those who are supposedly not so good. So he daily looks inward upon himself and then upward toward God, the better to discover just where he stands in this matter of honesty. Out of each of his meditations, there always emerges one dead certainty, that this is the fact that he still has a long way to go.
There you go.
You know, we said that too. somebody I know says, we're so sick when we show up in the rooms, we don't know we're sick. And then, you know, we're so sick, we think we're not as sick as other people. and then finally, we get so sick that we realize we're sick. And it's just crazy. And what it is it's revelations, you know, the dawning of revelations. And the only way for that to happen is through this thing called inventory, self-assessment.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. At the end of the day, we constructively review our day, you know, and we constantly pray and meditate. When we need to do inventory, we continue to take personal inventory. And all these things that we're being asked to do in the steps are about pulling back these layers,
mm-hmm.
these layers that are really destroying the quality of our life.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I can't tell you how many times people will look at me sideways, guys that I work with, when we're getting ready to do a four step and we're looking at the first two columns there on the four step. And I go, okay, so get ready, because this is the last time you're allowed to point out anything they did wrong. What? Are you serious? And I said, no, I'm telling you, I'm absolutely dead serious here. You know, and so then invariably what will happen as we go along, they'll bounce back to that first column again and, you know, do the yeah buts, right? Well, yeah, but you don't know, you don't understand how they did this. No, wait a minute. We left that behind three columns ago, guy. You know, we just don't want to take full responsibility. We just, I mean, a little bit,
no.
A little bit's got to be your fault, right? Come on, please.
It's just inconvenient if it's all on us. But you're right. It says their faults will not be discussed.
No.
Putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done us, we resolutely look at our own mistakes.
Yeah.
Those are the instructions.
Yep.
So just how and where, when to tell the truth or keep silent can often reveal the difference between genuine integrity and none at all. Step 9 of AA's program emphatically cautions us against misusing the truth when it states, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except to do so would injure them or others, because it points up the fact that the truth can be used to injure us as well as to heal. This valuable principle certainly has wide-ranging application to the problem of developing integrity. In AA, for instance, we talk a great deal about each other. Provided our motives are thoroughly good, this is not in the least wrong. But damaging gossip is quite something else. Of course, this kind of scuttlebutt can be well grounded in fact, but no such abuse of facts could ever be twisted to anything resembling integrity. It can't be maintained that this sort of superficial honesty is good for anyone. So the need to examine ourselves is very much with us. Following a gossip binge, we can well ask ourselves these questions. Why did we say what we did? Were we only trying to be helpful and informative? Or were we not trying to feel superior by confessing the other fellow's sins? Or because of fear and dislike, we were not really aiming to damage him? This would be an honest attempt to examine ourselves rather than the other fellow. Here we see the difference between the use of truth and its misuse. Right here we begin to regain the integrity we had lost. So he's really, this essay should really be called About Integrity.
Yeah.
You know? And Monty, I got to tell you, when I first showed up and I was working with Fish Food Phil, my first sponsor, all I could do is talk about how stupid other people were and the things that they did and how crazy they were. And isn't this weird that so-and-so does? I mean, I was a turbo gossip, right?
Turbo
and
gossip.
And he looked me right in the eye and he said this. He goes, Chris, you know, I was just at my mother's funeral and I need to tell you something about my mother. She never said a bad thing about another person. I never heard her say a bad thing about another person. And he looked me right in the eye. That's like how he would teach me, right?
Right.
He wouldn't say, Chris, you scumbag, all you do is talk crap about everybody. He wouldn't do that. He would teach me a lesson and I'd be looking at him and I could just picture his mother, you know, filled with integrity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because doesn't that paint a picture of integrity?
Oh, my gosh.
And here I am. I'm doing like the exact opposite every 5 seconds. and so I started. Part of my morning prayer was, God, please release me from this incessant need to judge, criticize, and gossip about others. And for 35 years, that's been part of my morning prayer.
Yeah.
And I think I'm finally to the point where my gossip is like 1% of what it used to be. You know what I mean?
Don't you think that this falls into the arena of we cease fighting anything or anyone?
Yes.
You know, it's almost like, so I've got to be real transparent here because of what I do in media. I have been referred to as the Andy Rooney of Recovery Radio. I take that as a compliment, but I also realized that they didn't mean it as a compliment, you know, because I'm critical, I'm overly opinionated, and I'm right, you know. And see, just that statement right there, I put a target on my back, right? So I have to be careful because I use critical stuff sometimes in jest, you know, as part of what I do in some of the other shows. But if I'm not careful, it can turn on me. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So you have to be careful. Because I've watched broadcasters. I can think of a couple right offhand that I really admired, and they went too far, and they're not broadcasting anymore. It's like, where'd they go? You know what I mean?
They became a bit too self-righteous.
They did. Yeah, they did. It wasn't funny anymore. They were getting, they were actually on the battlefield. Instead of just remarking about something and having a good chuckle at it, they were in the battle. And I don't want to be in the battle. I'm too tired, Chris. It's like this one guy he wants me to sponsor him. And I'm not going to chase him down. I'm just not going to, you know, and he's like, why haven't you called me? I go, because I have a sponsor, dude. You know, I'm too old and too tired to be fighting and trying to convince people of my way of thinking. I'm just not going to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I agree. I've changed completely the way I sponsor. You know what I mean? Like, I'm much more a long-term type of a sponsor than I am somebody that will, you know, that will hold a newcomer's hand. And I mean, you know, it's just, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I wish I still had the capacity and the patience and the time to put hours and hours and hours into somebody in their first 90 days. I don't have that available anymore. Yeah. So what's happened is kind of organically, you know, I've started to work with people with, you know, most of them have multiple decades, and that's more user friendly to me. You know, every once in a while, somebody will get off track and they'll want to call me every day or something like that. And they understand pretty quickly that, you know, that's not what I'm available for. Right. I'm not available for you to run things past me on a daily basis. You know, oh, I'm about to go to bed tonight. you know, just wanted to tell you it was a good day. Yeah, I am way not that guy.
I used to be, when I first started sponsoring, I was that guy, you know, call me every day for 30 days. You don't call me every day for 30 days, then you're not serious.
So I think I sponsor best by showing people what I do and how I do it. And I'm there to answer questions, you know, but you're the one that's going to have to put in the work.
Right.
I'm not a tugboat, you know what I mean? I'm not going to tug you into recovery. You know, I'll show you what I did and how I did it and make some suggestions. But if you're not committed, you know, to do this work and show up at meetings and all that stuff, I don't feel like it's effective for me to be spending a lot of time with you. I've learned the hard way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how I got on that. Let's get back to Bill. Sometimes, though, our true motives are not so easily determined. There are times we think when we must reveal highly damaging facts so that we may stop the depredations of certain evildoers, all for the good of AA or what have you. Now becomes our cry. Armed with this often false justification, we righteously press our attack. True enough, there may have been genuine need to remedy a damaging condition. True enough, we may have to make use of some unpleasant facts. But the real test is how we handle ourselves. We must be ever so certain that we are not pots who call the kettles black. Therefore, it is wise if we pose ourselves these questions. Do we really understand the people who are involved in this situation? Are we certain we have all of the facts? Is any action or criticism on our part really necessary? Are we positive that we are neither fearful nor angry? Only following such scrutiny can we be sure to act with the careful determination and the loving spirit that has always been needed to maintain our own integrity. Wow, those four questions, you know, I wish they were in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions or something. That's like the best of Bill stuff.
That reminds me, looks like I think it's the Rotary Club that has like five questions or something that you ask yourself every day, right? But you know, I'm thinking he's making mention of this because he has experience not doing these things.
So he was in some rough and tumble problems in the early days of AA, and he came out of it understanding that sometimes a good defense is no defense at all, and to attack just prolongs, you know, the conflict. So he was under fire from people out in the Midwest for decades. You know, Bill Wilson's a scoundrel. He's a swindler. He's stealing money. He was under like real serious fire, not like you and I have ever gotten. And he came out of that acting with integrity. I think, you know, it's not like he came out of the womb perfect.
Yeah.
He was in some bloody, you know, conflict.
Sure.
And for him to not attack some of these people, not jump onto the battlefield claiming his personal righteousness, instead, you know, asking themselves these questions, I think that's amazing. I think that's part of, you know, the spiritual life that Bill was really rolling himself into. You know?
I had somebody respond to one of the episodes of Walking Through the Big Book just last week, and they were like, "Well, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not putting Bill Wilson on a pedestal. I mean, he left his inheritance to his mistress, and he cheated on his wife for years, and they just went on and on and on. I've heard all this stuff before."
Sure.
You know, and I'm looking at these questions here. You know, okay, lady, do you really understand him? Did you know him? How many times did you have breakfast with Bill? I want to ask, do you have all the facts? Are you just echoing what somebody else said? Is this response to this podcast episode, is it necessary? Right.
Yeah.
So, and I'm like, I have to answer no to these questions when it came to this lady's response. It was like, what was the point? I don't get it.
You know, the person who discovered penicillin, are you worrying about his married life?
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. Or are you grateful that he discovered penicillin and you're not dying of infections?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of the way I see it today, Monty.
Yeah.
You know? Sure,
yeah.
He was imperfect. He was an imperfect person. I'm glad he was an
Me
imperfect
too.
Person. Because I'm an imperfect person,
yeah.
And I can relate to him. If he was, you know, some perfect guy, like coming right out of the gate, I don't know that this program would be attractive. But he recognizes his imperfections, and he's worked on them. And we don't know what kind of relationships he had with his wife and, you know, his friend Helen and all. We really don't, because that kind of stuff happened back when nobody talked about it.
That's right.
So I'm not even convinced it was an affair, because I've seen no proof of that.
You know, William Borchert, who he and his wife were very good friends with Lois. And William told me, he was dead serious, because we had a lady in the studio the first time we interviewed William. And for those who are listening who don't know who he is, he's the screenwriter for My Name's Bill W. And she said, well, you know, Bill had an affair, right? And William Borchert said, you know what? Absolutely not. Absolutely. I will tell you right now that is absolutely a lie. You know, my wife and I knew Lois. We knew her very well. We knew the family. She absolutely not. He convinced me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just haven't seen convincing proof.
Yeah.
I believe that Helen saw the greatness in Bill, and also saw that he was a little dysfunctional and needed some help, you know, managing all this crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And I think she decided she was going to be the girl. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, that makes more sense to me than anything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Bill was not a good looking dude, you know, by the time the 50s rolled around, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, he was no Brad Pitt. So I, you know, I'm just, listen, and it wouldn't make any difference to me.
Yeah, me either.
If it was full blown true, you know, that he was a swinger, you know, he invented penicillin, Monty.
Yeah, there you go.
You know what I mean?
Amen.
Amen. I can bypass all that other garbage.
Yeah, me too, buddy.
Anyway, now here is another aspect of the honesty problem. It is very possible for us to use the alleged dishonesty of other people as a most plausible excuse for not meeting our own obligations.
Mm.
I once had a spell of this myself. Some rather prejudiced friends had exhorted me to never go back to Wall Street. They were sure that the rampant materialism and double dealing down there would be sure to stunt my spiritual growth. Because this sounded so high-minded, I continued to stay away from the only business that I knew. When finally my household went quite broke, I woke up to the fact that I hadn't been able to face the prospect of going back to work. So I returned to Wall Street after all. And I've ever since been glad that I did. I needed to rediscover that there are many fine people in New York's financial district. Then, too, I needed the experience of staying sober in the very surroundings where alcohol had cut me down. I did receive all these benefits and a great deal more. Indeed, there was one colossal dividend that resulted directly from my grudging decision to re-enter the marketplace. It was a Wall Street business trip to Akron, Ohio in 1935 that first brought me face-to-face with Dr. Bob, AA's co-founder-to-be. So the birth of AA itself actually hinged on the fact that I had been trying to meet my bread-and-butter responsibilities. You know, he was on a proxy drive to take over a tire company at that time. Mm. We must now leave the absorbing topic of self-delusion and look at some of those trying life situations we have to meet foursquare and head on. Suppose we are handed an employment application that asks, have you ever suffered from alcoholism? And were you ever hospitalized? Here we A's can assuredly make a good report of ourselves. Almost to a man, we believe that nothing short of the absolute truth will do in a situation of this type. Most employers respect our fellowship, and they like this rugged brand of honesty, especially when we reveal our AA membership and its results. Of course, many another life problem calls for this identical brand of forthrightness. For the most part, situations requiring utter honesty are clear-cut and readily recognizable. We simply have to face up to them, our fear and pride regardless. Failing to do this, we shall be sure to suffer those ever-mounting conflicts which can only be resolved by plain honesty. There are nevertheless certain occasions where reckless truth-telling may create widespread havoc and permanent damage to others. Whenever this seems possible, we are likely to find ourselves in a bad jam indeed. We shall be torn between two temptations. When conscience agonizes us enough, we may well cast all prudence and love to the winds. We may try to buy our freedom by telling the brutal truth no matter who gets hurt or how. But this is not the usual temptation. It is far more probable that we shall veer to the other extreme. We will paint for ourselves a most unrealistic picture of the awful damage we are about to inflict on others. By claiming great compassion and love for our supposed victims, we are getting set to tell the big lie, and be thoroughly comfortable about it too. When life presents us with a racking conflict like this, we cannot be altogether blamed if we are confused. In fact, our very first responsibility is to admit that we are confused. We may have to confess that, for the time being, we've lost all ability to tell right from wrong. Most difficult, too, will be the admission that we cannot be certain of receiving God's guidance because our prayers are so cluttered with wishful thinking. Surely this is the point at which we must seek counsel of our finest friends. There is nowhere else to go. Had I not been blessed and wise with loving advisors, I might have cracked up a long ago. A doctor once saved me from death by alcoholism because he obliged me to face up to the deadliness of that malady. Another doctor, a psychiatrist, later on helped me save my sanity because he led me to ferret out some of my deep lying defects. From a clergyman, I acquired the truthful principles by which AAs now try to live. By these precious friends did far more than supply me with their professional skills. I learned that I could go to them with any problem whatever. Their wisdom and their integrity were mine for the asking. Many of my dearest AA friends have stood with me in exactly the same relation. Oftentimes they could help where others could not, simply because they were AAs. You know, this, so within my sponsorship group, Monty, we allow people the freedom to be honest with us, so with each other. So we give each other spiritual license to, if they see something that's really concerning about us or where we're going or what we're doing or how we're thinking, we're allowed to talk to each other about it. And one of my sponsees had a real strong talk with me yesterday about something that really concerns him, and it has to do with my health. It has to do with how I'm living and the things that I'm not doing to take care of myself, right? Mm-hmm. And I took that as an expression of love from him. You know what I mean? Absolutely. And this is what's different, I think, about our fellowship and about how we relate to each other. And his motives were 100% pure. You know what I mean? It was mm-hmm. it was about my health. And we accept that kind of assessment from someone that we've given spiritual license to.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I'm sure you have people like that in your life.
Absolutely. I've got a core group of folks. They have permission to yank on my chain anytime they want to. Because here's the deal. If they're wrong, I'll get over the offense. But what if they're not? You know? So I would much rather they be mistaken and say something than say nothing. And then I end up, you know, at the short end of the stick for it. So, you know, but see, here again, when he's talking about honesty and opening up and being transparent and all that stuff, you know, the whole work that we do in the step work that helps us outgrow fear. In fact, that one quote, at once we begin to outgrow fear, right? So that is so vitally important, because all the opposite of everything he's talking about here, I think, is fueled by fear, don't you?
Yeah.
And so if we're so afraid to be transparent, everybody, and I, when I was working at the Adult and Teen Challenge program, I used to tell the guys there, everybody needs somebody in their life that isn't going to say, oh my God, I'd never thought that of you. Right?
Yeah,
everybody, everybody needs somebody that'll just look at them and go, I get it. You know? And when we don't have those kind of people in our lives, we're kind of walking on a rope without a net.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Monty. Of course, we cannot wholly rely on friends to solve all our difficulties. A good advisor will never do all of our thinking for us. He knows that each final choice must be ours. He will therefore help to eliminate fear, expediency, and self-deception, so enabling us to make choices which are loving, wise, and honest. The choice of such a friend is an all-important matter. We should look for a person of deep understanding and then carefully listen to what he has to say. In addition, we must be positive that our prospective advisor will hold our communications in the strictest confidence. Should he be a clergyman or a doctor or a lawyer, this can be taken for granted. But when we consult an AA friend, who should not be reluctant to remind him of our need for full privacy, intimate communication is normally so free and easy among us that an AA advisor may sometimes forget that we expect him to remain silent. The protective sanctity of this most healing of human relations ought never be violated. Mm. You know, so, you know, the sanctity of the fifth step. There's been times when I've done fifth steps and people have shared, you know, the entire fifth step with a whole bunch of people. I mean, yeah, that's really rare, Monty, right? Mm-hmm. But that did the other person more harm than it did me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So this sanctity, we need to look at this through our own eyes. You know, we must remain confidential. Mm-hmm. Such privileged communications have priceless advantages. We find them in the perfect opportunity to be as honest as we know how to be. We do not have to think of the possibility of damage to other people, nor need we fear ridicule or condemnation. Here, too, we have the best possible chance of spotting self-deception. If we are fooling ourselves, a competent advisor can see this quickly. And as he guides us out of our fantasies, we are surprised to find that we have few of the usual urges to defend ourselves against unpleasant truths. In no other way can fear, pride, and ignorance be so readily melted. After a time, we realize that we're standing firm on a brand new foundation of integrity. Like when the individual was sharing with me his observations yesterday, there was no fear. There was no pride. I accepted it, you know, like I would accept a doctor giving me a diagnosis for a cough or something.
Thank you
for that information. I'm going to take what you said seriously.
Yeah.
And let's work together on this, you know. I'll update you as time goes by about how well I'm doing with this effort, you know. That was my response. Let us therefore continue our several searches for self-deception, great or small. Let us painstakingly temper honesty with prudence and love. Let us never flinch from entire forthrightness whenever this is the requirement. How truth makes us free is something that AAs can well understand. It cuts the shackles that once bound us to alcohol. It continues to release us from conflicts and miseries beyond reckoning. It banishes fear and isolation. The unity of our fellowship, the love we cherish for each other, the esteem in which the world holds us, all of these are products of such integrity as, under God, we have been privileged to achieve. May we therefore quicken our search for still more genuine honesty and deepen its practice in all our affairs. Mm. Well, that was another good one, Monty. Yep. Holy mackerel.
Man. It's almost like reading a devotional. Say the truth, you know. Just love it. I love it.
So I'm gonna, you know, I know I've talked about this on other shows, but I want to finish up with this.
Yeah.
This book that I read called God, the Bestseller. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned it a couple of times mm-hmm. on the show. The people that were arranged around this particular editor, Axman, Bill Wilson included, right, were the absolute top experiential spirituality people in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not there. They weren't the religious leaders. They were, you know, they were a little bit more progressive in their understanding of religion and spirituality. They were more broad, open, and all-inclusive. So I would describe it as experiential spirituality rather than, you know, a denominational religion. And these people were like Huxley, Hurd, Albert Schweitzer, Martin Luther King Jr., Dorothy Day. I mean, I could go on and on and on. And these were the people that were wrapped around this guy, Axman, meeting on a weekly basis for like long-term spiritual growth meetings. like what book have you been reading? Here's some practices I'm doing. You know, what kind of prayers are you doing? And Bill was in that group.
Wow.
Of the top people, the people that have published monumental, groundbreaking spiritual literature and became amazing at, you know, transformational processes within the American society, right?
Yeah.
And Bill was in there with those guys.
Wow.
You know? Wow. And when I'm reading this stuff now, I'm just, you know, from whence it came, I just have so much respect for his life and how much he paid attention to spiritual growth.
Yeah. Yeah. You cause it's reflective. It's reflective in these articles. And who would have known, you know, reading grapevine articles, sitting in your meeting, waiting for the meeting to start, you know, who would have thought? Right.
And people think, oh, he was a cheater, and you know,
a shyster, and a liar.
You know, and he smoked a lot. And, you know, like, no, he was there, with the monsters of spirituality in the United States in the 50s and 60s.
You know, it's great because when people say, well, you know, he was this kind of man and that kind of man. And but you know what? He was God's man. He was God's man. And God used him in a way that was I mean, it changed everything in the world of dependencies. You know what I mean? It just it changed everything forever. It's so funny because I'm sitting here listening to you talk about the health issue thing, and I'll wrap up my end of it by saying this. So I was at one of the Came to Believe recovery retreats, and this gal, her name's Alicia. She's very much part of the staff and the people that work for Came to Believe, and she is also very much into health. Right. Well, most of the people that travel with this organization aren't. So she's kind of like the mom, right? She's like, "What are you doing? Don't put that in your mouth. Come on, you know." Well, she knows that I've, and since I started the journey of taking care of myself, I've lost, believe it or not, this shirt is huge on me. I've lost 60 pounds, and I've got,
wow,
I've got 40 to go. So anyway, so she's very aware of the temptations that so easily beset me when it comes to my health. So we're sitting in, it's the morning session, and they're bringing in donuts from some mom and pop donut place downtown Portland. It's just phenomenal, right? It's not a chain, it's a private lane. And these donuts come in, and somebody hands me one, and I go to take a bite of it. I look over, and she is staring me down, man. You know, she is staring me, and I took a bite out of it. And so it was funny because we were talking about it the other day on the Came to Believe show. And she goes, "I remember that. Did you finish that?" I go, "I couldn't do it. I took one bite and I just could not get your face out of my mind." You know, she said, "Well, good for you." But the thing is, I was laughing about it. And this is what she said. She goes, "It's not funny." I'm just like, ooh, she's right.
Yeah.
It's not sugar.
Yeah, she's right.
And carbs. I mean, and processed food. It's killing us, man.
Yeah, you ever notice a donut is like heaven to eat, and once you've eaten it, you're in remorse?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's like you want to go to
for the rest of the day. It's like, you're remorseful. It's like doing drugs.
It's like, take me to the confessional, man. All right. Okay, another great show. Well, listeners, that wraps it up for this episode of Walking Through the Language of the Heart. Next week, this matter of fear. Ah, interesting. This is kind of following up with this. Okay, stay tuned to all the way to the end of the show, my friends, to listen to how you can get caught up on all the episodes. Until our next broadcast, this is the Monty Man along with Chris S., and we are wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
This has been a Chicken and a Pig production.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof, woof.